Welcome to the IRIS podcast. Today's edition comes from the Perth and Kinross Council personalisation event, recorded on February 16th, 2011. In this talk, Carl Stern and Paul Henderson examine personalisation initiatives in Perth and Kinross.
Hope you all enjoyed your coffee. You had presentations this morning, and there are more interview style for the second half of the morning, and then you'll have lots of work to do in the afternoon. I'd like to introduce Paul. Paul Henderson, many of you will know, as service manager for people with learning disabilities. And we have Kim Marshall, who is a carer, as well as active in his community. And many of you may know Kim. His son, Christopher, is known to some of you. He has, is he 23, you said, this weekend?
Yes.
And he has Down syndrome. So welcome to the two of you. And we've heard a lot this morning about personalization, allowing people to take more control over their own lives. And in Perth and Kinross, we like to think we've been on this path for the last 4 or 5 years. And I remember myself being involved many years ago in learning disability services with the transfer of people out of hospital into their own accommodation. So that's where I'd like to start. And if I could ask you, Paul, what personalization has meant for people and their accommodation needs in terms of what we've been doing in Perth and Kinross.
It's probably better to start with what isn't personalised accommodation, as a sort of to help define it. I mean, many of the clients that with learning disabilities we've helped move out of hospital have moved into their own tenancies. And if you non-personalised housing for me or accommodation support is hospital based, is institutional based, is private hospital based, is large residential specialist homes. Many of our clients that we moved back to Perth Kinross, we moved back 17 from out of area, some in England. There isn't a worse definition of personalization than moving someone completely away from their community into an institutional setting. And usually stuck in the middle of nowhere. And I really like what Sam was saying about personalization being for everyone. And, you know, we've created 24 supported tenancies for people with the most complex needs. So personalization isn't just for people who have milder disabilities or less needs. It needs to be for everyone. And Wendy was talking about, when she was at this conference and it was asked, in a few years' time, which one of you would like to be in a residential home mm-hmm. and go to a day centre? And no one stood up. No one said, that's what I want to do. And it's no different for people, regardless of their disabilities. And it's really been quite a profound experience in some ways, taking someone from a really institutional setting who's been living away from their community in a hospital or in a private hospital, because although many private hospitals were closed and shut down, what happened is that people moved to private hospitals and private nursing homes, often again away from their communities. One example, we've helped move people with sexually harmful behaviours from hospital to their own tenancies. And we had a service user advocacy group. We had an advocate who helped them express their views, and it was really struck me was being in this group where people were in hospital ward type situations, locked wards, with very little choice. And it's not to say that staff weren't fantastic, but just institutional care, and they were given the opportunity to choose the colour scheme for the flats, to choose the sort of flooring they liked. Probably for the first time, they were getting the choice to actually choose the colour scheme and where they lived. And it has had a profound effect on these people in terms of just the quality of life. And I know that we can sometimes in community care do a qualitative numbers game in terms of where we are in terms of progress. But working with these people, and it was a small number that came from that hospital with the sexual harmful behaviours, 10 people. But the impact on their life was huge.
Excellent. The other thing Sam spoke about, he spoke about somebody who really didn't want daycare, for whom daycare, respite.
Yeah.
That respite didn't work. And in Perth and Kinross, we've had a short breaks bureau, which has taken a different way of looking to forms of respite for clients. Can you say a bit about that?
I guess the idea previously we provided residential respite. And you know the idea is laudable because the respite is to give carers a break. It's just unfortunate that in order to give carers a break, we move people to institutional residential respite care. And we've sort of turned it round. So a short breaks bureau, if it helps people understand, it's a bit like a travel agent that you go to organise your holiday. Now, I know that many people don't use a travel agent now, they go on the internet, but the principle is the same. And I think that just as now people want to organise the holidays themselves and do it themselves through the internet rather than go to Butlins or some package tour, most people like to do it themselves. And I think that Short Breaks Bureau is a kind of cultural expression of that. It's not saying, okay, this is a respite unit you can go to for 6 weeks a year or for 2 weeks a year. What we're saying with the Short Breaks Bureau is, here's how much money you have to spend. You can organise whatever you want, you know. And for some people, that can be an adventure holiday, or it can be a camping expedition with support. For others, they prefer to use it across the year. So maybe every second or third Sunday, they would like a certain amount of hour support. So it kind of puts the control back to them. And because I think choice is probably one of the key elements of personalization. So it gives them the choice how they want to do it. And one other thing I say is when I started at Perth Kinross, my office was based at Birch Avenue, which is where the respite unit was. And so I remember I'd be getting there early because I always work long hours. So I'd get there early and be sort of walking into the building with my briefcase. And I'd see sort of people like looking out the windows from the respite unit who were staying there. And I just thought, who goes to a holiday in a residential unit where there's nurses going about, where there's social workers and nurses having meetings, where there's doctors? You just wouldn't do that.
No, well, some of the people we work with obviously have been doing that for a long time, and
exactly.
That's the purpose of personalisation, is to make that shift. So that's been very, very helpful in saying that people have, certainly the people for short breaks have a lot of choice and are being asked a question, how do you want to experience your break or your respite? Or,
maybe, one example, we had a carer whose daughter was going through transition, and she was very, very angry. She heard that Birch Avenue was closing, and she demanded a meeting with me. She said she didn't like Birch Avenue. She felt it was institutional. But she said there was no other place that could keep her daughter safe. Her daughter was so vulnerable and had such high needs that only Birch Avenue could do that. And there was nothing left. She liked the idea of the short breaks, but it just wouldn't work. Well, we did have the meeting and basically persevered with the idea of let's do something a bit different. And now our daughter goes to, there's a holiday lodges have been set up in Glen Almond. Someone set them up in a farm. Like the holiday lodges any of us would go to, mm-hmm. Overlooking Highland glens, etc. And really tranquil, etc. And now our daughter loves it, and she loves it, so she's completely committed to it. But I think people have this, it's a cultural change we've had to go through and had to challenge ourselves, our staff,
and our service users
and carers.
Because you're talking, and we'll talk later exactly. About risk assessment in the context of outcomes, but there was a parent who was very worried about taking a different risk with respite to getting with getting a break. I'd like to move on to Kim for a moment, sitting there being very patient.
And nervous.
There aren't 200 sets of eyes looking at you, Kim. Just So as a carer, what have been the main challenges facing you?
Well, I don't think it'll be any surprise to any parent or any carer about what I say. I mean, when Christopher was born, the days afterwards it was, will he be safe? Will he be happy? Will he be all that he could be? And those come after, will I cope? And those things, they're always there, but the balance between them changes as you go through their life. If I'd listened to the GP on Christopher's first visit to the doctors, who said, don't be too worried because he won't react, he'll have poor muscle tone, he'll probably want to sleep an awful lot, don't expect too much. If I'd listened to him, Christopher wouldn't have gone to Taiwan swimming for his country and be able to swim 50 metres butterfly in 40 seconds. If we didn't believe that Christopher was capable of more, then that advice would have drastically changed our world, because we wouldn't have done the things that we had.
And he's just come back from
the
Olympics in Taiwan. Yeah, excellent.
So,
wonderful.
Yeah, it's everybody wants the best, and by trying to achieve the best, you do so many other things as well. His health is better, so he's hardly ever ill. He's happy because he's achieving something. So just trying to do the latter helps you with the others.
And these are, I suppose, what we would call outcomes for people that they want in life. Can you describe a bit of your progress towards getting there?
Bumpy. Mm-hmm. Bumpy. I think everybody will say that the safety bit is sort of predominant in your mind with somebody with a learning difficulty. It's always the what ifs and the what if this goes wrong, what if that goes wrong. And it's always the transition. You can get your child into nursery and you go through these 2 years of nice routine, it's safe, and then you transfer to primary school, then you transfer to secondary school, and then you go to college, and then you are where we are, which is even more scary, trying to find employment. But it's always as if you are groundbreaking. You're the first parent that's ever had to go through these transitions. At least that's what it feels like. Because the process for doing it has been sort of like set. Mm-hmm. And delivery has always been set, which makes it really difficult when you've got somebody with, you know, an individual need and parents who have got their own individual aspirations for the person they're caring for.
And you've been using transition as a term for moving from one part of your life into the next.
Into another, and everybody goes through those processes.
Because we commonly talk about transitions between school and adulthood, but you're saying there are several in life.
Yeah, and every single one of them holds its own concerns for any carer. Okay.
Can I just come in there? Because you mentioned about risk and keeping safe and that being of primary importance. And, you know, if... I think that it's not to say that we shouldn't take account of risk, and I think it's just how you do it. You know, I think it's positive risk taking. Mm-hmm. And you know, going back to the accommodation, you know, we move people who to some extent were dangerous to others as well as themselves, either because of the extreme sort of challenging behavior or the sexualized behavior. And initially, when we looked at some of the risk assessments, when you see it in black and white, you think, "Oh my God, what are we doing?" But it's not a laissez-faire attitude where you just think, "Well, let's just move them into the community." What you do is positive risk-taking. You know, you basically assess and put in risk control plans to support these people. So you're taking a calculated risk, and to take, you know, it's been fine. And I think it's not either we must keep people in residential care and this type of approach or very fixed daycare, mm-hmm. Because that's the only thing that's safe. And of course, that's what parents think, and it's completely natural. It's not just saying that's either that or we just let them mm-hmm. everyone to do what they want.
But the business of risk seems to me to be combined with also recognizing people's positive attributes and their strengths and building on those. And one of the discussions we wanted to have today was to recognize person-centered planning has been around as a, and was mentioned this morning, has been around in Perth and Kinross for several years. The business of recovery and mental health adopts a lot of similar values and principles. And more recently, we've been moving to the business of what we call outcomes-based assessments, if we're using our kind of jargon. And that has asked people to review the whole basis of assessment, including that of risk. What do you think has been valuable about these models shifting through person-centered planning through to where we are now with outcomes?
I mean, I think we have made tremendous progress. So, I mean, now we have 154 people with learning disabilities who have a personal life plan. So, you know, we can now say if you come and use our in-house council services, that's the approach we are using. I mean, the valuable thing is about strengths, and that's been mentioned throughout this morning. It's about the strengths that people have, not the deficits. And, you know, the feedback from the outcome-focused review and assessment that work have been feeding back is that it's a much deeper conversation that they're having with people. Mm-hmm. Because it's not just about a tick list, you can't do this, you can't do that, and you can't do this. It's more about, what can you do? You know, what are you good at? And it's also more of a partnership approach, because it's not just saying, well, you're the passive recipient of care, I'm the expert, and we've got the services here, and we'll help meet these needs. It's about saying to the person, you know, what is it that you want to achieve, and setting the goals with them, so that, you know, they have an investment in it. One thing that really struck me was we did an in control or self-directed support model for five people that were coming through transition in 2009-2010. Where the carer did the self-assessment, their own assessment of the service user, their son or daughter, and then did a support plan. They wrote it themselves with some support. And I remember seeing the support plans to have a look over them and authorize them. And I couldn't get my head around them, because there was nothing about what they couldn't do. It was all about what they wanted to be, mm-hmm. What they were good at, what they enjoyed. There was a nice smiley photo usually in them, and it was just a completely radical departure from, say, some of the, particularly when they concentrate just on the risks, you know, this person can't do that, okay. They can't do this, and they can't okay. do that. So I think
so
that's
people are perfectly capable, as has been said earlier this morning, of working out what a kind of life plan should look for them and what they want out of life if we give them the resources. And that you're describing as having kicked off a couple of years ago. I was going to ask, but you've begun to describe that people in deciding what they want are not necessarily choosing from existing services, they're reinventing what they want by way of support. Has that had an impact on people's notion about what day services are about?
Well, completely. We've 4 years ago we had four day centres, and although there were some sort of community trips, etc., the majority of the work was done in the day centres, and we had cooks there, etc. So they were a kind of institutional framework way of doing stuff. I mean, we're now working out of two day centres, but at least 70% of the activities we have are taken outside them. And I think the key thing is that people are choosing what they want to do.
Okay. I'm kind of conscious we've got about 5 minutes of our time left, and there's a...
Carry on asking Paul questions.
Well, there are a couple of things. One, there's a new bill coming out about self-directed support with a kind of 10-year plan, and it sounds to me as though we're working towards that way of service. Do any of you have any idea, either of you have any idea what impact the bill will have on us, briefly?
That's yours. Not having read a bill.
it's If it can push us more towards some of the stuff that Sam Newman was talking about, I think that would be really helpful.
Okay.
And we've got 124 people with direct payments, and we're doing really well with children direct payments. We've got 32, so that's really impressive. We're on the right road, but you know, 124 people with direct payments with a huge amount of clients we've got, isn't huge. Mm-hmm. I think if we can look at supporting parents, users to use direct payments, maybe by using different models like brokerage models and working with the independent sector to help support them. So because often what parents say is, I don't have enough time to manage this budget. I don't have enough time to manage the staff. Okay. So if we can push us down that way, I think that would be useful.
Very helpful. We've also begun on the road of reablement, and I'm not going to ask a lot about that, but I know there's 40 people. First of all, people get screened to be assessed to whether they're suitable for reablement, but we have introduced this into Perth City, and it's about to be extended to the rural areas. And there are at least 40 people for whom, when they've been reabled, don't need any service at all. And I'm presuming that they're going to be living their lives the way that they want to live them, and have felt equipped and strengthened to do that. But I want to end on a note which might, I don't know if it's going to take more than a couple of minutes, because I want to refer to Big Society that was referred to earlier. What Changing Lives call building community capacity, and just how we encourage, you know, occupational, personal, social supports as an integral role within our communities, which was talked about earlier, not being shipped out, but that Wendy started with that this morning, talking about how important it was for communities to take responsibility for that. And you're active in your community.
Yeah, I guess it's true to say it's a bit of a bugbear of mine that it's people in a locality are better able to see what the problems are that affect them. And they can sometimes see simple solutions, but not know how to implement them. So we started a scheme in Crieff called Building Bridges. We had a meeting, big meeting last year, invited local charities, local firms, the police, all the carers that we knew about and the cared for. And we had an event a bit like this, but more fun. Through a chance combination of people that were at one specific table, befriending was consistently mentioned. Wouldn't it be great if X could go to the pub, or B could go and get their hair cut, or go to the theatre, but the problem is finding somebody to go with them, because parents' taxes only stretch so far. And the Soroptimists were there. Fantastic people, the Soroptimists. So organised. We now have a befriending scheme in Crieff. 8 Soroptimists, all gone through the CRB checks, all meeting people that have said that they want a chum to take them out somewhere of an evening, of a day. It's a purely voluntary thing. Families have come forward through the clubs that we attend, have said, yeah, I'd like, and they meet up, and the carers say, yeah, I like her, and she gets on with them, and off they go and do something.
So it's been a benefit to people in the community as well.
Yeah, it's just something that sparked. And at that event, there were lots of other big issues that came up, like travel, respite, employment, but being sort of just parents and carers, we can't tackle it all at one go. It's a bit like trying to eat an elephant, you know. The only way you can do it is one bit at a time. If you thought about eating the whole elephant, you'd just give up. So at the end of this month, we're organising a transport event, because we felt that that was another area where there were some quick fixes. So we've even got the pleasure of Stagecoach coming to see us, which, you know, we were quite pleased about, because that has a significant impact on a lot of our users' lives. So that's our next one, and hopefully we can build on the success of the Befrienders to find something that's easily achieved within the community without saying, council, we want transport. Because as soon as you go through that conversation in the past, it's always been about more money, more people, more resources, more time, and just at the moment, that's not really the sorts of requests that are going to be very successful. So there are lots of things that we can do ourselves that make lives easier for ourselves.
Now we're going to have to wind up, and okay. I'm going to ask Paul something, but I wanted to leave you with a final word, Kim, to think about what our key message should be. But Paul, I know we've talked previously, and you mentioned a cycle project or repair project, which involved, in terms of work, integrated into the community with both members of the public and what we would call our service users.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think what Kim's been active in, and our local area coordinators have been developing, is fantastic, absolutely fantastic, and that's the way we want to go forward. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's partnership working. And sort of working on it together, that is without doubt where we want to go.
Okay. Kim?
Communication. It's basically down to, no matter how hard it is, finding out what people really need rather than which of the services they think they can best use, because choices for things that don't really suit aren't really choices at all. And it's sometimes difficult to understand what people really want.
So that's back down to being good listeners, mm-hmm. having information, being creative, and yep. letting people lead. Thank you both ever so much for being here today.
Thank you.